I don't think it's ever been fired. Alfred came smiling at Denise, making her retreat toward the door. I will finish up in here, he said. Upstairs it was Christmas Eve. Packages were accumulating beneath the tree. In the front yard, the nearly bare branches of the swamp white oak swung in a breeze that had shifted to more snow-threatening directions. The dead grass snagged dead leaves. Enid was peering out through the sheer curtains again. Should I be worried about Chip? I would worry that he's not coming, Denise said, but not that he's in trouble. The paper says rival factions are fighting for control of central Vilnius. Chip can take care of himself. Oh, here, Enid said, leading Denise to the front door. I want you to hang the last ornament on the advent calendar. Mother, why don't you do that? No, I want to see you do it. The last ornament was the Christ baby in a walnut shell. Pinning it to the tree was a task for a child, for someone credulous and hopeful. And Denise could now see very clearly that she'd made a program of steeling herself against the emotions of this house, against the saturation of childhood memory and significance. She could not be the child to perform this task. It's your calendar, she said. You should do it. The disappointment on Enid's face was disproportionately large. It was an ancient disappointment with the refusal of the world in general and her children in particular to participate in her preferred enchantments. I guess I'll ask Gary if he'll do it, she said with a scowl. I'm sorry, Denise said. I remember you used to love pinning on the ornaments when you were a little girl. You used to love it. But if you don't want to do it, you don't want to do it. Mom, Denise's voice was unsteady. Please don't make me. If I'd known it would seem like such a chore, Enid said, I never would have asked you. Let me watch you do it, Denise pleaded. Enid shook her head and walked away. I'll ask Gary when he gets back from shopping. I'm so sorry. She went outside and sat on the front steps, smoking. The air had a disturbed, southern, snowy flavor. Down the street, Kirby Root was winding pine rope around the post of his gas lamp. He waved, and she waved back. When did you start smoking? Enid asked her when she came inside. About 15 years ago. I don't mean to criticize, Enid said, but it's a terrible habit for your health. It's bad for your skin, and frankly, it's not a pleasant smell for others. Denise, with a sigh, washed her hands and began to brown the flour for the sauerkraut gravy. If you're going to come and live with me, she said, we need to get some things clear. I said I wasn't criticizing. One thing we need to be clear about is that I'm having a hard time. For example, I didn't quit the generator. I was fired.
Fired?
Yes. Unfortunately. Do you want to know why?
No.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Denise, smiling, stirred more bacon grease into the bottom of the Dutch oven.
Denise, I promise you, her mother said, we will not be in your way. You just show me where the supermarket is and how to use your washer, and then you can come and go as you please. I know you have your own life. I don't want to disrupt anything. If I could see any other way to get Dad into that program, believe me, I would do it. But Gary never invited us, and I don't think Caroline would want us anyway.
The bacon fat and the browned ribs and the boiling kraut smelled good. The dish, as prepared in this kitchen, bore little relation to the high-art version that she'd plated for 1,000 strangers. The generator's ribs and the generator's monkfish had more in common than the generator's ribs and these homemade ribs had. You thought you knew what food was. You thought it was elemental. You forgot how much restaurant there was in restaurant food, and how much home was in homemade. She said to her mother, "Why aren't you telling me the story of Norma Green?"
"Well, you got so angry with me last time," Enid said. I was mainly mad at Gary. My only concern is that you not be hurt like Norma was. I want to see you happy and settled. Mom, I'm never going to get married again.
You don't know that.
Yes, in fact, I do know that. Life is full of surprises. You're still very young and very darling. Denise put more bacon fat into the pot. There was no reason to hold back now. She said, "Are you listening to me? I'm quite certain that I will never get married again." But a car door had slammed in the street, and Enid was running into the dining room to part the sheer curtains.
"Oh, it's Gary," she said, disappointed. "Just Gary."
Gary breezed into the kitchen with the railroad memorabilia that he'd bought at the Museum of Transport. Obviously refreshed by a morning to himself, he was happy to indulge Enid by pinning the Christ baby to the advent calendar. And as quickly as that, Enid's sympathies shifted away from her daughter and back to her son. She crowed about the beautiful job that Gary had done in the downstairs shower and what a huge improvement the stool there represented. Denise miserably finished the dinner preparations, assembled a light lunch, and washed a mountain of dishes while the sky in the windows turned fully gray. After lunch, she went to her room, which Enid had finally redecorated into near-perfect anonymity, and wrapped presents. She'd bought clothes for everyone. She knew what people liked to wear. She uncrumpled the Kleenex that contained 30 sunny caplets of Mexican A and considered wrapping them up as a gift for Enid, but she had to respect the limits of her promise to Gary. She balled the caplets back into the Kleenex, slipped out of her room and down the stairs, and stuffed the drug into the freshly vacated 24th pocket of the advent calendar. Everybody else was in the basement. She was able to glide back upstairs and shut herself in her room as if she'd never left. When she was young, when Enid's mother had browned the ribs in the kitchen and Gary and Chip had brought home their unbelievably beautiful girlfriends, and everybody's idea of a good time was to buy Denise a lot of presents, this had been the longest afternoon of the year. An obscure natural law had forbidden whole family gatherings before nightfall. People had scattered to wait in separate rooms. Sometimes, as a teenager, Chip had taken Mercy on the last child in the house and played chess or Monopoly with her. When she got a little older, he'd brought her along to the mall with his girlfriend of the moment. There was no greater bliss for her at 10 and 12 than to be so included. To take instruction from Chip in the evils of late capitalism, to gather couturial data on the girlfriend, to study the length of the girlfriend's bangs and the height of her heels, to be left alone for an hour at the bookstore, and then to look back from the top of the hill above the mall on the silent, slow choreography of traffic in the faltering light. Even now it was the longest afternoon. Snowflakes a shade darker than the snow-colored sky had begun to fall in quantity. Their chill found its way past the storm windows. It skirted the flows and masses of furnace-heated air from the registers. It came right at your neck. Denise, afraid of getting sick, lay down and pulled a blanket over herself. She slept hard, with no dreams, and awoke. Where? What time? What day? To angry voices. Snow had webbed the corners of the windows and frosted the swamp white oak. There was light in the sky, but not for long.
"Al, Gary went to all that trouble."
"I never asked him to."
"Well, can't you try it at least once, after all the work he did yesterday?"
"I am entitled to a bath if I want to take a bath."
"Dad, it's only a matter of time before you fall on the stairs and break your neck."
"I am not asking anyone for help."
"You're damn right you're not, because I have forbidden Mom, forbidden her to go anywhere near that bathtub."
"Al, please, just try the shower."
"Mom, forget it. Let him break his neck. We'd all be better off."
"Gary!"
The voices were coming closer as the contretemps moved up the stairs. Denise heard her father's heavy tread pass her door. She put her glasses on and opened the door just as Enid, slow on her bad hip, reached the top of the stairs.
"Denise, what are you doing?"
"I took a nap."
"Go talk to your father. Tell him it's important that he try the shower that Gary did so much work on. He'll listen to you."
The depth of her sleep and the manner of her awakening
had put Denise out of phase with external reality. The scene in the hall and the scene in the hall windows had faint antimatter shadows. Sounds were at once too loud and barely audible.
"Why," she said, "why are we making an issue of this today?"
"Because Gary's leaving tomorrow, and I want him to see if the shower's going to work for Dad."
"And tell me again what's wrong with the bath?"
"He gets stuck, and he's so bad on the stairs."
Denise closed her eyes, but this substantially worsened the phase sink problem. She opened them.
"Oh, plus, and Denise," Enid said, "you haven't worked with him on his exercises yet like you promised."
"Right, I'll do that."
"Do it now, before he gets cleaned up. Here, I'll get you the sheet from Dr. Hedgepeth."
Enid limped back down the stairs, and Denise raised her voice. "Dad?" No answer. Enid came halfway up the stairs and pushed through the rails of the banister a violet sheet of paper, "Mobility is Golden," on which stick figures illustrated 7 stretching exercises.
"Really teach him," she said. "He gets impatient with me, but he'll listen to you. Dr. Hedgepeth keeps asking if Dad's doing his exercises. It's very important that he really learn these. I had no idea you were sleeping all this time."
Denise took the instruction sheet into the master bedroom and found Alfred in the doorway of his closet, naked from the waist down.
"Whoa, Dad, sorry," she said, retreating.
"What is it?"
"We need to work on your exercises."
"I'm already undressed."
"Just put some pajamas on. Loose clothing is better anyway."
It took her 5 minutes to calm him down and stretch him out on his back on the bed in his wool shirt and his pajama bottoms. And here, at last, the truth came pouring out. The first exercise required that Alfred take his right knee in his hands and draw it toward his chest, and then do the same with his left knee. Denise guided his wayward hands to his right knee, and although she was dismayed by how rigid he was getting, he was able, with her help, to stretch his hip past 90 degrees. "Now do your left knee," she said. Alfred put his hands on his right knee again and pulled it toward his chest.
"That's great," she said, "but now try it with your left."
He lay breathing hard and did nothing. He wore the expression of a man suddenly remembering disastrous circumstances.
"Dad, try it with your left knee."
She touched his left knee, to no avail. In his eyes, she saw a desperate wish for clarification and instruction. She moved his hands to his left knee, and the hands immediately fell off. Possibly his rigidity was worse on the left side. She put his hands back on his knee and helped him raise it. If anything, he was more flexible on the left.
"Now you try it," she said.
He grinned at her, breathing like someone very scared.
"Try what?"
"Put your hands on your left knee and lift it."
"Denise, I've had enough of this."
"You'll feel a lot better if you can do a little stretching," she said. "Just do what you just did. Put your hands on your left knee and raise it." The smile she gave him came reflected back as confusion. His eyes met hers in silence.
"Which is my left?"
he said. She touched his left knee.
"This one."
"And what do I do?"
"Put your hands on it and pull it toward your chest."
His eyes wandered anxiously, reading bad messages on the ceiling.
"Dad, just concentrate."
"There's not much point."
"Okay," she took a deep breath. "Okay, let's leave that one and try the second exercise, all right?"
He looked at her as if she, his only hope, were sprouting fangs and antlers.
"So in this one," she said, trying to ignore his expression, "you cross your right leg over your left leg, and then let both legs fall to the right as far as they can go. I like this exercise," she said. "It stretches your hip flexor. It feels really good."
She explained it to him 2 more times, and then asked him to raise his right leg. He lifted both legs a few inches off the mattress.
"Just your right leg," she said gently, "and keep your knees bent."
"Denise!"
His voice was high with strain. "There's
no point."
"Here," she said. "Here." She pushed on his feet to bend his knees. She lifted his right leg, supporting it by the calf and thigh, and crossed it over his left knee. At first there was no resistance, and then, all at once, he seemed to cramp up violently.
"Denise!"
"Dad, just relax." She already knew that he was never coming to Philadelphia. But now, a tropical humidity was rising off him, a tangy, almost smell of letting go. The pajama fabric on his thigh was hot and wet in her hand, and his entire body was trembling.
"Oh, shoot," she said, releasing his leg.
Snow was swirling in the windows, lights appearing in the neighbors' houses. Denise wiped her hand on her jeans and lowered her eyes to her lap, and listened, her heart beating hard, to the labored breathing of her father and the rhythmic rustling of his limbs on the bedspread. There was an arc of soak on the bedspread near his crotch and a longer capillary action reach of wetness down one leg of his pajamas. The initial, almost smell of fresh piss had resolved, as it cooled in the underheated room, into an aroma quite definite and pleasant.
"I'm sorry, Dad," she said. "Let me get you a towel."
Alfred smiled up at the ceiling and spoke in a less agitated voice.
"I lie here, and I can see it," he said. "Do you see it?"
"See what?" He pointed vaguely skyward with one finger.
"Bottom on the bottom, bottom on the bottom of the bench," he said. "Written there. Do you see it?"
Now she was confused, and he wasn't. He cocked an eyebrow and gave her a canny look.
"You know who wrote that, don't you? The fur fellow with the, you know."
Holding her gaze, he nodded significantly.
"I don't understand what you're talking about," Denise said.
"Your friend," he said. "Fella with the blue cheeks."
The first 1% of comprehension was born at the back of her neck and began to grow to the north and to the south.
"Let me get a towel," she said, going nowhere.
Her father's eyes rolled up toward the ceiling again.
"He wrote that on the bottom of the bench. Bottom of the bench. And I lie there and I can see it."
"Who are we talking about?"
"Your friend in signals, fellow with the blue cheeks."
"You're confused, Dad. You're having a dream. I'm going to get a towel."
"See? There was never any point in saying anything."
"I'm getting a towel," she said.
She crossed the bedroom to the bathroom. Her head was still in the nap that she'd been taking, and the problem was getting worse. She was falling further out of sync with the waveforms of reality that constituted towel softness, sky darkness, floor hardness, air clearness. Why this talk of Don Armor? Why now? Her father had swung his legs out of bed and peeled off his pajama bottoms. He extended his hand for the towel when she returned.
"I'll clean this mess up," he said. "You go help your mother."
"No, I'll do it," she said. "You take a bath."
"Just give me the rag. It's not your job."
"Dad, take a bath."
"It was not my intention to involve you in this."
His hand, still extended, flopped in the air. Denise averted her eyes from his offending, wetting penis.
"Stand up," she said. "I'm going to take the bedspread off."
Alfred covered his penis with the towel.
"Leave that to your mother," he said. I told her Philadelphia is a lot of nonsense. I never intended to involve you in any of this. You have your own life. Just have fun and be careful."
He remained seated on the edge of the bed, his head bowed, his hands like large, empty, fleshy spoons on his lap.
"Do you want me to start the bath water?" Denise said.
"I know. None,
he said.
"Told the fellow. He was talking a lot of nonsense, but what can you do?"
Alfred made a gesture of self-evidence or inevitability.
"Thought he was going to Little Rock. You go," I said. "Gotta have seniority. Well, that's a lot of nonsense. I told him to get the hell out."
He gave Denise an apologetic look and shrugged.
"What else could I do?"
Denise had felt invisible before, but never like this.
"I'm not sure what you're saying," she said.
"Well,"
Alfred made a vague gesture of explanation,
"he told me to look under the bench. Simple as that. Look under the bench if I didn't believe him."
"What bench?"
"It was a lot of nonsense," he said. "Simpler for everybody if I'd just quit. You see, he never thought of that."
"Are we talking about the railroad?"
Alfred shook his head.
"Not your concern. It was never my intention to involve you in any of this. I want you to go and have fun and be careful. Tell your mother to come up here with a rag."
With this, he launched himself across the carpeting and shut the bathroom door behind him. Denise, to be doing something, stripped the bed and balled everything up, including her father's wet pajamas, and carried it downstairs.
"How's it going up there?"
Enid asked from her Christmas card station in the dining room.
"He wet the bed," Denise said. "Oh, my word.
He doesn't know his left leg from his right." Enid's face darkened.
"I thought maybe he'd listen better to you." "Mother, he doesn't know his left leg from his right. Sometimes the medication..."
"Yeah, yeah," Denise's voice was plangent.
"The medication."
Having silenced her mother, she proceeded to the laundry room to sort and soak the linens. Here, Gary, all smiles, accosted her with an O-gauge model railroad engine in his hands.
"I found it," he said. "Found what?"
Gary seemed hurt that Denise hadn't been paying close attention to his desires and activities. He explained that half of his childhood model railroad set, the important half with the cars and the transformer, had been missing for decades and presumed lost.
"I just took the entire storeroom apart," he said. "And where do you think I found it?"
"Where?"
"Guess," he said.
"At the bottom of the rope box," she said. Gary's eyes widened.
"How did you know that?" "I've been looking for decades."
"Well, you should have asked me. There's a smaller box of railroad stuff inside the big rope box."
"Well, anyway..."
Gary shuddered to accomplish a shift of focus away from her and back to him. "I'm glad I had the satisfaction of finding it, although I wish you'd told me."
"I wish you'd asked. You know, I'm having a great time with this railroad stuff. There are some truly neat things that you can buy."
"Good, I'm happy for you." Gary marveled at the engine he was holding.
"I never thought I'd see this again."
When he was gone, and she was alone in the basement, she went to Alfred's laboratory with a flashlight, knelt among the U-Ban cans, and examined the underside of the bench. There, in shaggy pencil, was a heart the size of a human heart, and the initials D.A. and D.L. inside it. She slumped onto her heels, her knees on the stone-cold floor. Little Rock. Seniority. Simpler if I just quit. Absently, she raised the lid of a U-Ban can. It was full to the brim with lurid orange fermented piss.
Oh, boy,
she said to the shotgun. As she ran up to her bedroom and put on her coat and gloves, she felt sorriest about her mother, because no matter how often and how bitterly Enid had complained to her, she'd never got it through her head that life in St. Jude had turned into such a nightmare. And how could you permit yourself to breathe, let alone laugh or sleep or eat well, if you were unable to imagine how hard another person's life was? Enid was at the dining room curtains again, looking out for Chip.
"Going for a walk," Denise called as she closed the front door behind her.
2 inches of snow lay on the lawn. In the west, the clouds were breaking up. Violent eyeshadow shades of lavender and robin's egg blue marked the cutting edge of the latest cold front. Denise walked down the middle of tread-marked twilight streets and smoked until the nicotine had dulled her distress and she could think more clearly. She gathered that Don Armour, after the Roth brothers had bought the Midland Pacific and commenced their downsizing of it, had failed to make the cut for Little Rock and had gone to Alfred and complained. Maybe he'd threatened to brag about his conquest of Alfred's daughter. Or maybe he'd asserted his rights as a quasi-member of the Lambert family. Either way, Alfred had told him to go to hell. Then Alfred had gone home and examined the underside of his workbench. Denise believed that there had been a scene between Don Armour and her father, but she hated to imagine it. How Don Armour must have loathed himself for crawling to his boss's boss and trying to beg or blackmail inclusion in the railroad's move to Little Rock. How betrayed Alfred must have felt by this daughter who'd won such praise for her work habits. How dismally the entire intolerable scene must have turned on the insertion of Don Armour's dick into this and that guilty, unexcited orifice of hers. She hated to think of her father kneeling beneath his workbench and locating that penciled heart, hated the idea of Don Armour's drecky insinuations entering her father's prudish ears, hated to imagine how keenly it offended a man of such discipline and privacy to learn that Don Armour had been roaming and poking through his house at will. "It was never my intention to involve you in this." Well, and sure enough, her father had resigned from the railroad. He'd saved her privacy. He'd never breathed a word of any of this to Denise, never given any sign of thinking less of her. For 15 years, she'd tried to pass for a perfectly responsible and careful daughter, and he'd known all along that she was not. She thought there might be comfort in this idea, if she could manage to keep it in her head. As she left her parents' neighborhood, the houses got newer and bigger and boxier. Through windows with no mullions or fake plastic mullions, she could see luminous screens, some giant, some miniature. Evidently, every hour of the year, including this one, was a good hour for staring at a screen. Denise unbuttoned her coat and turned back, taking a shortcut through the field behind her old grade school. She'd never really known her father. Probably nobody had. With his shyness and his formality and his tyrannical rages, he protected his interior so ferociously that if you loved him as she did, you learned that you could do him no greater kindness than to respect his privacy. Alfred, likewise, had shown his faith in her by taking her at face value, by declining to pry behind the front that she presented. She'd felt happiest with him when she was publicly vindicating his faith in her, when she got straight A's, when her restaurants succeeded, when reviewers loved her. She understood, better than she would have liked to, what a disaster it had been for him to wet the bed in front of her. Lying on a stain of fast-cooling urine was not the way he wished to be with her. They only had one good way of being together, and it wasn't going to work much longer. The odd truth about Alfred was that love, for him, was a matter not of approaching, but of keeping away. She understood this better than Chip and Gary did, and so she felt a particular responsibility for him. To Chip, unfortunately, it seemed that Alfred cared about his children only to the degree that they succeeded. Chip was so busy feeling misunderstood that he never noticed how badly he himself misunderstood his father. To Chip, Alfred's inability to be tender was the proof that Alfred didn't know or care who he was. Chip couldn't see what everyone around him could, that if there was anybody in the world whom Alfred did love purely for his own sake, it was Chip. Denise was aware of not delighting Alfred like this. They had little in common beyond formalities and achievements. Chip was the one whom Alfred had called for in the middle of the night, even though he knew Chip wasn't there. "I made it as clear to you as I could," she told her idiot brother in her head as she crossed the snowy field. "I can't make it any clearer." The house to which she returned was full of light. Gary or Enid had swept the snow from the front walk. Denise was scuffing her feet on the hemp mat when the door flew open.
"Oh, it's you," Enid said. "I thought it might be Chip."
"No, just me." She went in and pried her boots off. Gary had built a fire and was sitting in the armchair closest to it, a stack of old photo albums at his feet. "Take my advice," he told Enid, "and forget about Chip."
"He must be in some sort of trouble," Enid said. "Otherwise he would have called."
"Mother, he's a sociopath. Get it through your head."
"You don't know a thing about Chip," Denise said to Gary.
"I know when somebody refuses to pull his weight."
"I just want us all to be together," Enid said.
Gary let out a groan of tender sentiment. "Oh, Denise," he said. "Oh, come and see this baby girl."
"Maybe another time."
But Gary crossed the living room with the photo album and foisted it on her, pointing at the photo image on a family Christmas card. The chubby, mop-headed, vaguely Semitic little girl in the picture was Denise at about 18 months. There was not a particle of trouble in her smile or in the smiles of Chip and Gary. She sat between them on the living room sofa in its pre-reupholstered instantiation. Each had an arm around her, their clear-skinned boy faces nearly touched above her own.
"Is that a cute little girl?" Gary said.
"Oh, how darling," Enid said, crowding in.
From the center pages of the album fell an envelope with a registered mail sticker. Enid snatched it up and took it to the fireplace and fed it directly to the flames.
"What was that?" Gary said.
"Just that Axon business, which is taken care of now."
"Did Dad ever send half the money to Orphic Midland?"
"He asked me to do it, but I haven't yet. I'm so swamped with insurance forms."
Gary laughed as he went upstairs.
"Don't let that $2,500 burn any holes in your pocket."
Denise blew her nose and went to peel potatoes in the kitchen.
"Just in case," Enid said, joining her, "be sure there's enough for Chip. He said this afternoon at the latest."
"I think it's officially evening now," Denise said.
"Well, I want a lot of potatoes."
All of her mother's kitchen knives were butter knife dull. Denise resorted to a carrot scraper.
"Did Dad ever tell you why he didn't go to Little Rock with Orphic Midland?"
"No,"
Enid said emphatically. "Why?"
"I just wondered."
"He told them, yes, he was going, and Denise, it would have made all the difference for us financially. It would have nearly doubled his pension just those 2 years. We would have been in so much better shape now. He told me he was going to do it. He agreed it was the right thing. And then he came home 3 nights later and said he'd changed his mind and quit."
Denise looked into the eyes semi-reflected in the window above the sink.
"And he never told you why?"
"Well, he couldn't stand those Roths. I assumed it was a personality clash, but he never talked about it with me. You know, he never tells me anything. He just decides. Even if it's a financial disaster, it's his decision and it's final."
Here came the waterworks.
Denise let Potato and Scraper fall into the sink. She thought of the drugs she'd hidden in the advent calendar. She thought they might stop her tears long enough to let her get out of town, but she was too far from where they were stashed. She'd been caught defenseless in the kitchen.
"Sweetie, what is it?"
Enid said. For a while there was no Denise in the kitchen, just mush and wetness and remorse. She found herself kneeling on the rag rug by the sink. Little balls of soaked Kleenex surrounded her. She was reluctant to raise her eyes to her mother, who was sitting beside her on a chair and feeding her dry tissues.
"So many things you think are going to matter," Enid said with a new sobriety, "turn out not to matter."
"Some things still matter," Denise said.
Enid gazed bleakly at the unpeeled potatoes by the sink.
"He's not going to get better, is he?"
Denise was happy to let her mother think that she'd been crying about Alfred's health.
"I don't think so," she said. "It's probably not the medication, is it?"
"It probably isn't."
"And there's probably no point in going to Philadelphia," Enid said, "if he can't follow instructions."
"You're right. There probably isn't."
"Denise, what are we going to do?"
"I don't know."
"I knew something was wrong this morning," Enid said. "If you'd found that envelope 3 months ago, he would have exploded at me, but you saw today he didn't do a thing."
"I'm sorry I put you on the spot there."
"It didn't even matter. He didn't even know."
"I'm sorry anyway."
The lid on a pot of white beans boiling on the stove began to rattle. Enid stood up to reduce the heat. Denise, still kneeling, said,
"I think there's something in the advent calendar for you." "No, Gary pinned the last ornament in the 24 pocket. There might be something for you." "Well, what?"
"I don't know. You might go check, though."
She heard her mother make her way to the front door and then return. Although the pattern of the rag rug was complex, she thought she would soon have it memorized from staring.
"Where did these come from?" Enid said.
"I don't know."
"Did you put them there?"
"It's a mystery."
"You must have put them there."
"No."
Enid set the pills on the counter, took 2 steps away from them, and frowned at them severely.
"I'm sure whoever put these there meant well," she said. "But I don't want them in my house."
"That's probably a good idea."
"I want the real thing, or I don't want anything."
With her right hand, Enid herded the pills into her left hand. She dumped them into the garbage grinder, turned on water, and ground them up.
"What's the real thing?"
Denise said when the noise subsided.
"I want us all together, for one last Christmas."
Gary, showered and shaved and dressed in his aristocratic style, entered the kitchen in time to catch this declaration. "You'd better be willing to settle for 4 out of 5, he said, opening the liquor cabinet. "What's wrong with Denise?"
"She's upset about Dad."
"Well, it's about time," Gary said. "There's plenty to be upset about." Denise gathered up the Kleenex balls.
"Pour me a lot of whatever you're having," she said. "I thought we could have Bee's champagne tonight," Enid said.
"No," Denise said.
"No," Gary said.
"We'll save it and see if Chip comes," Enid said. "Now, what's taking Dad so long upstairs?"
"He's not upstairs," Gary said.
"Are you sure?"
"Yes, I'm sure."
"Al?" Enid shouted. "Al?"
Gases snapped in the neglected fire in the living room. White beans simmered on moderate heat. The registers breathed warm air. Out in the street, somebody's tires were spinning on snow.
"Denise," Enid said, "go see if he's in the basement."
Denise didn't ask, "Why me?" although she wanted to. She went to the top of the basement stairs and called her father. The basement lights were on, and she could hear a cryptic, faint rustling from the workshop. She called again. "Dad?"
There was no answer. Her fear as she descended the stairs was like a fear from the unhappy year of her childhood when she'd begged for a pet and received a cage containing two hamsters. A dog or a cat might have harmed Enid's fabrics, but these young hamsters, a pair of siblings from a litter at the Driblet residence, were permitted in the house. Every morning when Denise went to the basement to give them pellets and change their water, she dreaded to discover what new deviltry they'd hatched in the night for her private spectation. Maybe a nest of blind, wriggling, incest crimson offspring, maybe a desperate, pointless, wholesale rearrangement of cedar shavings into a single great drift beside which the two parents were trembling on the bare metal of the cage's floor, looking bloated and evasive after eating all their children, which couldn't have left an agreeable aftertaste even in a hamster's mouth. The door to Alfred's workshop was shut. She tapped on it. "Dad?" Alfred's reply came immediately in a strained, strangled bark.
"Don't come in!"
Behind the door, something hard scraped on concrete. "Dad? What are you doing?"
"I said don't come in!"
Well, she'd seen the gun, and she was thinking, "Of course it's me down here," she was thinking, "and I have no idea what to do."
"Dad, I have to come in.
Denise!"
"I'm coming in," she said.
She opened the door to brilliant lighting. In a single glance, she took in the old paint-spattered bedspread on the floor, the old man on his back, with his hips off the ground and his knees trembling, his wide eyes fixed on the underside of the workbench while he struggled with the big plastic enema apparatus that he'd stuck into his rectum.
"Whoops, sorry,"
she said, turning away, her hands raised. Alfred breathed stertorously and said nothing more. She pulled the door partway shut and filled her lungs with air. Upstairs, the doorbell was ringing. Through the walls and the ceiling, she could hear footsteps approaching the house.
"That's him! That's him!" Enid cried.
A burst of song, "It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas," punctured her illusion. Denise joined her mother and brother at the front door. Familiar faces were clustered around the snowy stoop. Dale Driblet, Honey Driblet, Steve and Ashley Driblet, Kirby Root with several daughters and buzz-cut sons-in-law, and the entire Person clan. Enid corralled Denise and Gary and hugged them closer, bouncing on her toes with the spirit of the moment.
"Run and get Dad," she said. "He loves the carolers."
"Dad's busy," Denise said. For the man who'd taken care to protect her privacy, and who had only ever asked that his privacy be respected too, wasn't the kindest course to let him suffer by himself and not compound his suffering with the shame of being witnessed? Hadn't he, with every question that he'd ever failed to ask her, earned the right to relief from any uncomfortable question she might want to ask him now? Like, "What's with the enema, Dad?" The carolers seemed to be singing straight at her. Enid was swaying to the tune. Gary had easy tears in his eyes, but Denise felt like the intended audience. She would have liked to stay there with the happier side of her family. She didn't know what it was about difficulty that made such a powerful claim on her allegiance, but as Kirby Root, who directed the choir at Chiltsville Methodist, led a segue into Hark the Herald Angels Sing, she began to wonder if respecting Alfred's privacy wasn't a little bit too easy. He wanted to be left alone? Well, how nice for her! She could go back to Philadelphia, live her own life, and be doing exactly what he wanted. He was embarrassed to be seen with a plastic squirter up his ass? Well, how convenient! She was pretty goddamned embarrassed herself. She extricated herself from her mother, waved to the neighbors, and returned to the basement. The workshop door was ajar as she'd left it. "Dad?"
"Don't come in!"
"I'm sorry," she said, "but I have to come in."
"I never intended to involve you in this. Not your worry."
"I know, but I have to come in anyway."
She found him in much the same position, with an old beach towel wadded up between his legs. Kneeling among the shit smells and piss smells, she rested a hand on his quaking shoulder.
"I'm sorry," she said.
His face was covered with sweat. His eyes glittered with madness.
"Find a telephone," he said, "and call the district manager."
Chip's great revelation had come at about 6 o'clock on Tuesday morning, as he was walking in near-perfect darkness down a road surfaced with Lithuanian gravel between the tiny hamlets of Neravai and Mishkinyai, a few kilometers from the Polish border. 15 hours earlier, he'd reeled out of the airport and had nearly been run over by Jonas and Aidaris and Gitanas as they veered to the curb in their Ford Stomper. The three men had been on their way out of Vilnius when they'd heard the news of the airport's closing. Pulling a U-turn on the road to Ignalina, they'd returned to rescue the pathetic American. The Stomper's rear cargo area was fully constipated with luggage and computers and telephone equipment, but by bungee-cording two suitcases to the roof, they made room for Chip and his bag. "We'll get you to a small checkpoint," Gitanas said. "They're putting roadblocks on all the big roads. They salivate when they see Stompers." Jonas had then driven at unsafe speeds on suitably awful roads west of Vilnius, skirting the towns of Jieznas and Alytus. The hours had passed in darkness and jostling. At no point did they see a working streetlight or a law enforcement vehicle. Jonas and Aidaris listened to Metallica in the front seat while Gitanas pressed buttons on his cell phone in the forlorn hope that Trans-Baltic Wireless, of which he was still nominally the controlling shareholder, had managed to restore power to its transceiver station in the midst of a national blackout and the mobilization of Lithuania's armed forces. "This is a calamity for Vidkunas," Gitanas said. "Mobilizing just makes him look more Soviet. Troops in the street and no electricity. This will not endear your government to the Lithuanian people."
"Is anybody actually shooting at people?" Chip asked.
"No, it's mostly posturing. A tragedy rewritten as a farce."
Toward midnight, the Stomper rounded a sharp curve near Lazdijai, the last sizable town before the Polish frontier, and passed a 3-jeep convoy heading in the opposite direction. Jonas accelerated on the corduroy road and conferred with Gitanas in Lithuanian. The glacial moraine in this region was rolling but unforested. It was possible to look back and see that two of the jeeps had turned around and commenced pursuit of the Stomper. It was likewise possible, if you were in the jeeps, to see Jonas making a sharp left onto a gravel road and speeding alongside the whiteness of a frozen lake. "We'll outrun him," Gitanas assured Chip approximately 2 seconds before Jonas, encountering an elbow curve, rolled the Stomper off the road. "We're having an accident," Chip thought while the vehicle was airborne. He experienced huge retroactive affection for good traction, low centers of gravity, and non-angular varieties of momentum. There was time for quiet reflection and gritting of teeth, and then no time at all, just blow after blow, noise upon noise. The Stomper tried out several versions of the vertical, 90, 270, 360, 180, and finally came to rest on its left side, with its engine dead and its lights still burning. Chip's hips and chest felt seriously bruised by his lap and shoulder belts, otherwise he seemed to be in one piece, as did Jonas and Aidaris. Gitanas had been thrown around and bludgeoned by loose luggage. He was bleeding from wounds on his chin and forehead. He spoke to Jonas urgently, apparently telling him to cut the lights, but it was too late. There was a sound of great downshifting on the road behind them. The pursuing jeeps pulled up at the elbow curve, and uniformed men in ski masks piled out.
"Police in ski masks," Chip said. "I'm struggling to put a positive construction on this."
The Stomper had crashed in a frozen-over marsh. In the intersecting high beams of two jeeps, 8 or 10 masked officers surrounded it and ordered everybody out. Chip, pushing open the door above him, felt like a jack emerging from its box. Jonas and Aidaris were relieved of their weapons. The contents of the vehicle were methodically dumped on the crusty snow and broken reeds that covered the ground. A policeman pressed the muzzle of a rifle into Chip's cheek, and Chip received a one-word order that Gitanas translated.
"He's inviting you to take your clothes off."
Death, that overseas relation. that foul-breath remittance man had suddenly appeared in the immediate neighborhood. Chip was quite afraid of the gun. His hands shook and lost feeling. It took the entire sum of his will to apply them to the task of unzipping and unbuttoning himself. Apparently he'd been singled out for this humiliation because of the quality of the leather goods he was wearing. Nobody seemed to care about Gitanas's red motocross jacket or Jonas's denim. But ski-masked policemen gathered round and fingered the fine grain of Chip's pants and coat. Puffing frost through O-shaped mouth holes with their weirdly decontextualized lips, they tested the flexure of his left boot's sole. A cry went up when a wad of U.S. currency fell from the boot. Again the gun muzzle was in Chip's cheek. Chilly fingers discovered the big envelope of cash under his T-shirt. The police examined his wallet as well, but didn't steal his lite or his credit cards. Dollars were all they wanted. Gitanas, with blood congealing on several quadrants of his head, lodged a protest with the captain of the police, the ensuing argument in which Gitanas and the captain repeatedly gestured at Chip and used the words dollars and American, ended when the captain pointed a pistol at Gitanas's bloody forehead, and Gitanas raised his hands to concede that the captain had a point. Chip's sphincter had meanwhile dilated nearly to the degree of unconditional surrender. It seemed very important to contain himself, however, and so he stood in his socks and underwear and pressed his butt cheeks together as well as he could with his shaking hands. Pressed and fought the spasms manually. He didn't care how ridiculous this looked. The police were finding much to steal from the luggage. Chip's bag was emptied on the snowy ground, and his belongings picked through. He and Gitanas looked on while the police shredded the stomper's upholstery, tore up its floor, and located Gitanas's reserves of cash and cigarettes. "What exactly is the pretext here?" Chip said, still shivering violently but winning the really important battle. "We're accused of smuggling currency and tobacco," Gitanas said. "And who's accusing us?" "I'm afraid they're what they seem to be," Gitanas said. "In other words, national police and ski masks. There's kind of a Mardi Gras atmosphere in the country tonight, kind of an anything-goes type of spirit." It was 1 a.m. when the police finally roared away in their jeeps. Chip and Gitanas and Jonas and Idaris were left with frozen feet, a smashed-up stomper, wet clothes, and demolished luggage. On the plus side, Chip thought, I didn't shit myself. He still had his passport and the $2,000 that the police had failed to locate in his T-shirt pocket. He also had gym shoes, some loose-fitting jeans, his good tweed sport coat, and his favorite sweater, all of which he hurried to put on. "This pretty much ends my career as a criminal warlord," Gitanas commented. "I have no further ambitions in that direction." Using cigarette lighters, Jonas and Idaris were inspecting the stomper's undercarriage. Idaris delivered the verdict in English for Chip's benefit. "Truck fucked up." Gitanas offered to walk with Chip to the border crossing on the road to Seni, 15 kilometers to the west, but Chip was painfully aware that if his friends hadn't circled back to the airport, they would probably be safe now with their relatives in Ignalina, their vehicle and their cash reserves intact. "Eh," Gitanas said with a shrug, "we might have got shot on the road to Ignalina. Maybe you saved our life." "Truck fucked up," Idaris repeated with spite and delight. "So I'll see you in New York," Chip said. Gitanas sat down on a 17-inch computer monitor with a stove-in screen. He carefully felt his bloody forehead. "Yeah, right, New York. You can stay in my apartment. I'll think about it." "Let's just do it," Chip said, somewhat desperately. "I'm a Lithuanian," Gitanas said. Chip felt more hurt, more disappointed and abandoned than the situation called for. However, he contained himself. He accepted a road map, a cigarette lighter, an apple, and the Lithuanian's sincere good wishes, and set off in the darkness. Once he was alone, he felt better. The longer he walked, the more he appreciated the comfort of his jeans and gym shoes as hiking gear relative to his boots and leather pants. His tread was lighter, his stride freer. He was tempted to start skipping down the road. How pleasant to be out walking in these gym shoes! but this was not his great revelation. His great revelation came when he was a few kilometers from the Polish border. He was straining to hear whether any of the homicidal farm dogs in the surrounding darkness might be unleashed. He had his arms outstretched. He was feeling more than a little ridiculous when he remembered Gitanus's remark, "Tragedy rewritten as a farce." All of a sudden, he understood why nobody, including himself, had ever liked his screenplay. He'd written a thriller where he should have written farce. Faint morning twilight was overtaking him. In New York, he'd honed and polished the first 30 pages of The Academy Purple until his memory of them was nearly eidetic. And now, as the Baltic sky brightened, he bore down with a mental red pencil on his mental reconstruction of these pages, made a little trim here, added emphasis or hyperbole there, and in his mind, the scenes became what they'd wanted to be all along, ridiculous. The tragic Bill Quaintance became a comic fool. Chip picked up his pace, as if hurrying toward a desk at which he could begin to revise the script immediately. He came over a rise and saw the blacked-out Lithuanian town of Isiskas, and farther in the distance, beyond the frontier, some outdoor lights in Poland. Two dray horses, straining their heads over a barbed-wire fence, nickered at him optimistically. He spoke out loud. "Make it ridiculous. Make it ridiculous." Two Lithuanian customs officials and two policemen manned the tiny border checkpoint. They handed Chip's passport back to him without the bulky stack of lite that he'd filled it with. For no discernible reason except petty cruelty, they made him sit in an overheated room for several hours, while cement mixers and chicken trucks and bicyclists came and went. It was late morning before they let him walk over into Poland. A few kilometers down the road, in Seni, he bought zlotys and, using the zlotys, lunch. The shops were well stocked. It was Christmas time. The men of the town were old and looked a lot like the Pope. Rides in three trucks and a city taxi got him to the Warsaw airport by noon on Wednesday. The improbably apple-cheeked personnel at the LOT Polish Airlines ticket counter were delighted to see him. LOT had added extra holiday flights to its schedule to accommodate the tens of thousands of Polish guest workers returning to their families from the West, and many of the westbound flights were underbooked. All the red-cheeked counter girls wore little hats like drum majorettes. They took cash from Chip, gave him a ticket, and told him, "Run." He ran to the gate and boarded a 767 that then sat on the runway for 4 hours while a possibly faulty instrument in the cockpit was examined and finally, reluctantly, replaced. The flight plan was a great circle route to the great Polish city of Chicago, non-stop. Chip kept sleeping in order to forget that he owed Denise $20,500, was maxed out on his credit cards, and now had neither a job nor any prospect of finding one. The good news in Chicago, after he'd cleared customs, was that two rental car companies were still doing business. The bad news, which he learned after standing in line for half an hour, was that people with maxed out credit cards could not rent cars. He went down the list of airlines in the phone book until he found one, Prairie Hopper, never heard of it, that had a seat on a St. Jude flight at 7 the next morning. By now it was too late to call St. Jude. He chose an out-of-the-way patch of airport carpeting and lay down on it to sleep. He didn't understand what had happened to him. He felt like a piece of paper that had once had coherent writing on it but had been through the wash. He felt roughened, bleached, and worn out along the fold lines. He semi-dreamed of disembodied eyes and isolated mouths in ski masks. He'd lost track of what he wanted. And since who a person was what a person wanted, you could say that he'd lost track of himself. How strange, then, that the old man who opened the front door at 9:30 in St. Jude the next morning seemed to know exactly who he was. A holly wreath was on the door. The front walk was edged with snow and evenly spaced broom marks. The Midwestern street struck the traveler as a wonderland of wealth and oak trees and conspicuously useless space. The traveller didn't see how such a place could exist in a world of Lithuanias and Polans. It was a testament to the insulatory effectiveness of political boundaries that power didn't simply arc across the gap between such divergent economic voltages. The old street with its oak smoke and snowy flat-topped hedges and icicled eaves seemed precarious. It seemed mirage-like. It seemed like an exceptionally vivid memory of something beloved and dead.
"Well," Alfred said, his face blazing with joy as he took Chip's hand in both of his, "look who's here."
Enid tried to elbow her way into the picture, speaking Chip's name, but Alfred wouldn't let go of his hand. He said it twice more, "Look who's here. Look who's here."
"Al, let him come in and close the door," Enid said.
Chip was balking at the doorway. The world outside was black and white and gray, and swept by fresh, clear air. The enchanted interior was dense with objects and smells and colors, humidity, large personalities. He was afraid to enter.
"Come in, come in," Enid squeaked, "and shut the door."
To protect himself from spells, he privately spoke an incantation. "I'm staying for 3 days, and then I'm going back to New York. I'm finding a job. I'm putting aside $500 a month minimum until I'm out of debt, and I'm working every night on the script." Invoking this charm, which was all he had now, the paltry sum of his identity, he stepped through the doorway.
"My word, you're scratchy and smelly," Enid said, kissing him. "Now, where's your suitcase?"
"It's by the side of a gravel road in western Lithuania."
"I'm just happy you're home safely."
Nowhere in the nation of Lithuania was there a room like the Lambert living room. Only in this hemisphere could carpeting so sumptuously woolen and furniture so big and so well made and so opulently upholstered be found in a room of such plain design and ordinary situation. The light in the wood-framed windows, though gray, had a prairie optimism. There wasn't a sea within 600 miles to trouble the atmosphere, and the posture of the older oak trees reaching toward the sky had a jut of wildness and entitlement, predating permanent settlement, memories of an unfenced world were written in the cursive